Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio, read by Keith, amateur radio operator W0NX, featuring the May 2024 The Spectrum Monitor. We'll begin by finishing Radio 101 by Ken Reitz, KS4CR. Global Hearts and Minds, Who's Playing? Its high-powered Ku-band transponders and spot-beam to sub-Saharan Africa makes it a good candidate for direct-to-home broadcast TV and radio services. On this satellite alone are found SES 5, 5 degrees east. Voice of America offers 27 radio channels on C-band FTA satellite. Hemisphere coverage includes VOA, VOA 1, and 22 separate radio services for as many African countries. Additionally, VOA TV and audio services are found on the Ku band side of this satellite, beamed to sub-Saharan Africa, including VOA TV Africa and VOA TV Global, and 26 duplicate radio services. BBC. 4 BBC Africa video feeds, as well as 14 radio services via FTA C-band satellite, including English, Arabic, Pashto, Somali, Swahili, Persian, and French language services for hemispheric coverage that includes Europe, East Africa, West Africa, and the Middle East. 8 duplicated services are found on the same satellite on a different transponder, also FTA. BBC does not have Ku-band services on this satellite. RFI France. France 24, Francais. France 24, English. Beamed at sub-Saharan Africa in standard definition video, as well as 10 RFI radio services on the Ku-band side of SES 5. Deutsche Welle, Germany. Deutsche Welle, DW, offers DW English TV and 6 DW radio services beamed at sub-Saharan Africa on Ku-band. TRT World, Television Radio Turkey, 1 HDTV video service on Ku-band. Vatican, offers Vatican Media, standard definition video, and Radio Vaticana Europe, multilingual programming on Ku-band. China offers CCTV 4 Europe, CGTN Documentary, CGTN Francais, and CGTN on Ku-band. Eutelsat 70B, 70 degrees east. This is a Ku-band only satellite that was launched in 2012 with a 15-year life expectancy, which means it will need to be replaced in another 3 to 5 years. Most geostationary satellites will last several years past their design lifetime, unless they experience an anomaly such as loss of solar panels, batteries, or run out of station-keeping fuel. Voice of America offers 2 high-definition TV channels, VOA TV China and VOA Dewa TV, as well as 2 feeds of Radio Free Asia, RFA. And 1 feed of VOA Asia beamed to Central Asia on Ku-band. It also offers the same video channels, as well as RFA, VOA Asia, and Radio Free Tibetan. The UK-based MTA HD Asia also offers the VOA radio services VOA Tibetan and RFA Mandarin on Ku-band widebeam, which covers South Asia, including Tibet. Telstar 12 Vantage at 12 degrees west Ku-band. Western Hemisphere coverage for VOA TV Global, TV Marti, as well as radio services Voz de America, VOA 1, Radio Marti, and VOA Global Live are all found at this all-Ku-band satellite owned by Telesat, formerly Telesat Canada, and also owned by Laurel Space and Communications. Telstar 12 was launched in late 2015. This is another satellite nearing end-of-life expectancy. On paper, the coverage map would seem ideal for U.S. AGM purposes, covering Latin America with a strong spot beam over Cuba and the island of Hispaniola. No other international broadcast services use this satellite. SES-4, at 22 degrees west. A C-band satellite with Ku-band spot beams to Africa and the Caribbean. This satellite is also owned by SES. VOA is heard on one transponder beamed to Western Africa. Intelsat 901 at 27.5 degrees west. RTP International offers radio and TV programming from Portugal to Portuguese-speaking regions of Africa, including TV services RTP International Europa, RTP Africa, as well as radio services RDP Antenna 1, RDP Africa, and RDP International. BBC radio and TV services are found here, but are encrypted. According to Intelsat, on February 2020, a Northrop Grumman Mission Extension Vehicle, MEV-1, docked with Intelsat 901 for a first-ever in-space maneuver to refuel the geostationary orbit satellite and thereby extend its lifetime by another 5 years. Hispasat 30W5 and 30W6. These two Ku-band satellites, co-located at 30 degrees west and beamed to both Eastern Europe and Western Latin America hemispheres. Among TV and radio services found on 30W5 are Cuba Vision Internacional, international channel of Cuban state TV, Spanish beamed to Europe. RNE, Spain state radio. Four Spanish language radio services, RNE Exterior, RNE Nacional, beamed Latin America. Vatican Media TV and Radio Vaticana Europe, multilingual. DWTV Español, Deutsche Welle TV in Spanish. RFI, Radio France International, Francais, RFI Latina. On 30W6, beamed to Latin America, Cuba Vision Nacional, Cuba Vision Internacional, Telesur, Venezuelan State TV in Spanish, Radio Habana Cuba, and several other Cuban national radio stations. RDP Antenna 1, RDP Africa, RDP Antenna 1 Azores, RDP Antenna 1 Madeira, beamed to Europe and North Africa. Hispan TV, Iranian-produced world news in Spanish. SES 14, 47, C-band, degrees west. France 24, English, French, and Spanish language channels, RFI in multiple languages. Intelsat 34, 55.5 C-band degrees west. RTP International America TV Radio Portuguese. BBC World Service Radio, English, Spanish, Portuguese, and Arabic. CGTN4 America, English, Spanish, French. Intelsat 21, C-band only, 58 degrees west. Arirang World, South Korea English Cultural Political News. YTN World, 24/7 news of South Korea only in Korean. Korean Central TV DPRK, Korean language only. TRT World, Television Radio Turkey, English. NHK World Japan, English TV Radio. CGTN China, Chinese, English, Spanish, French language. Galaxy 19 KU band at 97 degrees west. Dozens of channels from around the world in English, including Press TV, the Iranian English news channel, as well as many others, home to World Radio Network. SES 3, KU Bend, at 103 degrees west, home to NHK TV, English, Taiwan World Plus, English, DWTV, English, NTA, Nigeria, in English. For half a century, there was essentially a single electronic platform from which to broadcast news to the world, shortwave radio. But emerging technologies, including geostationary satellites and a land-based web of connected computers that would become the Internet, were coming up fast on the horizon. This is where the bulk of U.S. programming lies. But the vulnerabilities of all of our communications systems are well known today. For this reason, the U.S. AGM plans to increase the shortwave transmission capacity at its Kuwait transmission station. It recognizes the low operating costs of shortwave. The strategic geographic position of the station, with antennas capable of targeting audiences in the Mideast, Africa, Russia, and South Asia, where use of shortwave radios remains high. It is also rebuilding damaged shortwave antennas on the Commonwealth of Northern Mariana Islands, CNMI, which were destroyed in the 2018 typhoon. Again, the strategic location of CNMI to China, Russia, the South Pacific, and Southeast Asia makes this an inexpensive communications alternative to a region where shortwave communications remain viable. The U.S. is not leaving shortwave behind while it continues to expand its reach via internet and satellite broadcasting, as well as in-country and border-country brokered AM/FM programming. And now, amateur radio insights by Kirk Kleinschmidt, NT0Z. NT0Z at stealthamateur.com. Modern mentors. Back in the glorious and horrible days before the internet, most amateur radio and electronics mentoring took place in person or not at all. If you had access to patient, knowledgeable Elmers, you were golden. If you didn't, you wandered in the proverbial wilderness, or you consulted your collection of books and magazines, perhaps even while spending time in a library building. There were few other options. My high school library had a rather complete collection of QST magazines from the 1940s onward, plus a great many ARRL handbooks and related publications. I would check the magazines out six at a time and read them during each class that I found too boring, and some that I actually enjoyed, such as journalism. Most of my mentors were found in the pages of QST and other ARRL publications. There were no hams in my family, and none in my family's circle of friends, so I mostly bootstrapped myself into amateur radio. But I did have a few interesting characters over the years who helped in specific ways, mostly when it came to homebrewing. As a teenage ham, I developed access to several old-timers who, while not really performing full Elmer duties, they did answer perplexing questions. They gave me tons of old-timey radios and parts, and they lent me radios and gear for special occasions. My mom worked as a civilian for the local Minnesota National Guard training base, which, at 63,000 acres, was no small operation. Camp Ripley also hosted the state's regional electronics maintenance facility, where everything from vehicle and tank radios to counter-battery radar systems were repaired. Although they weren't at all active, there were a few hams who worked in the electronics shop. One helped me install my first Rhone lattice tower, while another gave me the keys to the city, so to say. The shop had a shiny, sweet Collins KWM-2A HF transceiver and a large outdoor doublet, presumably for Mars. Other than to maintain its readiness, nobody used the station. So when it was discovered that I could safely tune and load the transmitter portion of the rig, I was allowed to use it, mostly on 40 meters. Getting there initially required a 16-mile round trip via bicycle, which was no biggie back in the day. After I had a car, a 1971 Volkswagen 411 wagon, loved that thing. My mom helped me secure a vehicle parking permit from the base commander, who was also an inactive ham and the son of our longtime family babysitter. So, yeah. With that pass, I could drive through the main gate, which was guarded by gun-toting soldiers even before 9/11, and park right next to the tower that supported the doublet antenna. At the time, I fiercely wished that Camp Ripley had its own log periodic HF beam, but the doublet would have to do. The third or fourth inactive ham at the facility, which was quite large, gave me a TCS-6 World War II Navy battleship transmitter and receiver, complete with a 100-pound dynamotor supply. I'm sure it had been taking up space in a storage room somewhere for decades. I set the beast up in my basement bedroom shack and used it on 80-meter CW, and very infrequently and unofficially on 1.5 megahertz for antenna testing, as the transmitter covered 1.5 to 12 megahertz AM and CW. As a blossoming homebrewer, in 1977, I built a Tuna Tin 2 40-meter QRP transmitter from the 1976 article in QST. To accommodate builders such as myself, the transformers in the transmitter were built around the ferrite core RF chokes, available at every local Radio Shack, mine included. The rest of the parts were available there too by design. With permission from the electronics teacher at the high school, I made the rig's PCB at school using a photocopy of the layout that I copied onto transparency paper in the library and further blackened out with a black permanent marker. The pattern was transferred to the photosensitive PCB material that, although rarely, if ever, used by students or teachers, was still tucked away in the electronics lab, as was a jug of ferric chloride etchant that still worked. Amazingly, the little transmitter worked. I managed to not solder to death the transistors or any of the other parts. Someone had given me a few 40-meter crystals, so when paired with the KWM-2A, I was making contacts all around the Midwest with only 250 milliwatts. Thus began my lifelong pursuit of mostly QRP operating. Bob sets the stage. Robert Sappington, call sign not remembered at press time, was a retired pipeline engineer who gave himself the complete Drake TR-7 line to celebrate his retirement. The TR-7 was ahead of its time in 1978 and looked sci-fi amazing. Bob set his Drake B twins aside after switching to the newer Drake lineup, and he would actually let me take the older Drakes to my shack to operate SSB-DX contests, which required a lot of split operation in the days before regional band alignment. My trusty Tempo 1 did not have its accessory external VFO, so the use of Bob's B-twins was much appreciated. Bob, who lived in my hometown of Little Falls, Minnesota, was mostly a low-band operator, and his small backyard sported a high-gain, high-tower multiband antenna. The big vertical had several shorter whips attached to a 32 to 40-foot length of lattice tower. It was some 50 feet tall when measured from the tallest whip. Of course, I didn't know then that the performance of the impressively big vertical, which now retails for a staggering $2,200, can be equaled or bettered by a $20 wire inverted L. But that didn't stop me from wanting one for myself. When I was 21, I decided that, since I'd been an active ham for 6 years, it was time to build an HF linear amplifier. I was looking to boost my low-band transmit performance, and I had a ready source of free iMac 4 400A vacuum tubes. I was working my way through college in Fargo at the time, and the engineer at KVOX AM/FM, where I worked as a newscaster, gave me all but a handful of his 4400A poles, which were used in the AM station transmitter and modulator. These beefy tubes, which looked like a 3500Z, were retired on schedule, not after failure, and they had plenty of life remaining in intermittent amateur service. I didn't have the cash to buy any new big iron parts, but Bob came to the rescue with surplus goodies and expert advice on how to repurpose things that were already on hand. The amp's high-voltage transformer in a big steel case started life in a huge Heathkit transmitter. It had a center-tapped secondary and was designed to be used in that manner. I, of course, needed to use the full secondary winding, untapped and ungrounded, which doubled the voltage input to the rest of the power supply. Bob knew that the windings, when used, abused, in this way, could flash over to the typically grounded transformer case, so he gave me four large ceramic standoffs on which to mount the transformer, which insulated the transformer case from the chassis and prevented flashover. The four 400A filaments require 5 volts at 15 amps, and I didn't have any transformers on hand that could handle that much current. I did have a dead car battery charger, however, with a huge low-voltage transformer. Bob showed me how to carefully remove the existing secondary winding and how to wind a new custom filament winding with 6-gauge insulated wire. Problem solved. With newer ceramic triodes, etc., the filament voltage needs to be tightly regulated in a pretty narrow range to avoid killing the super-sensitive devices. With older tech poles, however, a bit of extra filament voltage is just what the doctor ordered. I didn't initially have a way to adjust the filament voltage, but Bob said I could use a conventional 120-volt light dimmer on the primary to produce the adjustable 5-plus volt filament voltage, thus pepping up the ostensibly tired amplifier tube. For good measure, I had a dedicated filament voltage meter on the amplifier's front panel. As I recall, the power supply put out about 3,000 volts at 300 milliamps, which typically requires an expensive broadcast or military oil-filled filter capacitor, which for me was unobtainium. At Bob's suggestion, I bought a bunch of inexpensive electrolytic photoflash capacitors, each rated for 600 volts. I connected a bunch in series, tamed them with identical equalizing resistors, and mounted the entire capacitor string, which totaled about 40 microfarads at 4,000 volts, inside a custom plexiglass box that I drilled and glued shut. Why? In case the caps exploded, of course. To treat the amplifier with kid gloves on a continuous basis, I warmed up the filaments for a couple minutes before bringing up the high voltage with a dedicated Variac auto transformer that Bob had given me, which I still use in my shack to this day for working on vintage tube gear. This eliminated potential problems with inrush current and helped to ensure that my string of overworked filter caps didn't fail. Testing the high-voltage power supply required the most interesting seat-of-the-pants input from Mr. Sappington. I didn't happen to have any 1,000-watt high-voltage resistors on hand, so he suggested that I get a large Pyrex glass baking dish, fill it 2/3 full of distilled water, and fabricate a pair of large surface area electrodes, 3-inch square pieces of PCB, at each end of the water pan. We'll continue this article next time. Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio, read by Keith.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.